here today. So everybody, please welcome Sonia B.
Thanks, Jim. Can I ask Jim or Bill or Monica, will somebody give me a 5-minute warning? And how much time do I have? I try to be respectful of that.
It would be ideal to wrap up right at 5 to 8.
Okay. Well, I'm going to count on you to let me know, because watching this is kind of distracting, right?
Not a problem. I'll give you the five.
Perfect. And if I don't see it, if I get all wound up, just chime in. So I'm Sonia, and I'm an alcoholic. And that's the most profound thing I've ever come to know. Most important thing I've ever come to know. I'm from the Fresno group, the Treasures group. That's my home group. And I see on the screen the promise of many lifelong friends, and the other promise of my daughter. She's out there, and that brings tears to my eyes. Those of you that have loved ones that are sober or are not sober, it's real hard. So it's a real honor. And I'm particularly the women at New Visions. I'm so glad you're in the room. I really need this meeting. I really need to carry the message to new people as best I can. This situation we're all experiencing, I will only mention it in passing, is not good for this alcoholic. This kind of social isolation, because to me, the heart of Alcoholics Anonymous is not just us talking to each other, but being with each other, touching each other, spending the time. And that was an amazing gift that was given to me. It's the time people spent with me. So let me get started. I do what the book says. I try to tell a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I think the most important thing, if I never get sober here, you guys know I'm sober. I think the thing that makes Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the most important parts of its magic, is the identification. That until we got here, no one understood what we were about in this drinking. And it is a horrible, horrible disease. It does. You'll end up insane or locked up or dead or sober. There's no, like COVID, no asymptomatic alcoholism. It's symptomatic, and it's bad. It's bad symptoms. And the price we pay under this horrible obsession is, like I said, our very life. I grew up in the small town of Dos Palos. It's a little valley town. You guys may know of it, just off of Los Banos. Had about 1,000 people in it. It was a small town, very friendly, kind of like the Happy Days series on TV. I always say I was like a big frog in a little pond. Everybody knew my dad. Everybody knew everybody. I was cheerleader. I was class president. I was a real happy kid. I was a normal kid. My parents were not alcoholic. They didn't get divorced. And I just grew up in this amazing environment. And I was drawn to church. My mother sent me to Sunday school when I was little, but after that, my brothers quit going and my mother quit going, but I would walk to church. I'd walk 4 blocks to the church across town, and I was drawn to something there. Of course, that all went by the way as alcohol entered the picture, but I think it's important for me to share. When I first got sober, so it was a long time ago, and most everybody in the room had, you know, they were bad drunks in AA back in 48 years ago. They'd all been to jail, and my sponsor had been to Stockton State Hospital, locked up as cuckoo. And I just was thinking, oh my God, my story's not bad enough. You know, what am I going to do? As you'll see, it's bad enough. It's certainly horrible, but there's no jail and there's no divorces and no lost kids. But what I realize is what I want to say is there's somebody like me out there. And that's who, you know, will hopefully identify with my story. My story is my story. So I was a happy little kid. I enjoyed life. I was popular. I wasn't shy. You know, I hear so much of the alcoholic personality is this insecurity and shyness. And it just wasn't my story. And I didn't drink in high school. And my girlfriend, I found out later, my best girlfriend, they were drinking beer on the canal banks, but they didn't invite me because I guess I was just too goody two shoes. You know, they just didn't think I would do it. So I went to Coalinga Junior College, and that's where I was introduced to alcohol. Went to my first college party, and tell this story in a little bit of detail because although the disease did progress, all the horrible things about this disease were there for me that first drunk. So very innocently, it's a loud party. The music's so loud, and this guy says, "You want a?" I thought he said a Roman Coke, and I didn't. I said, "What? What's a Roman Coke?" And I could never hear him. So I said, "Just bring me one. Yeah, whatever it is, I'll take one." And of course, it was a rum and coke, and I drank as many as I could, as fast as I could. Just instinct. Just give me one, give me more of that. I don't remember it changing my world like some people that first drink. It just was mad. It was just instinct to drink as much as I could, as fast as I could. And I'm a blackout drinker. I don't know that I can't, maybe one or two. In my 8 years of drinking, did I not black out? So I come to, it's still party night, late in the evening now, after midnight, and I'm up on I can't remember now if it was an oil derrick or a water tower, but somehow I climbed up some huge tall structure. Got up there and then couldn't figure out how to get down and kind of sobered up there. And I mean, is this alcoholic? So somebody says, "You want us to send some beer up?" Because I was afraid to climb down. I mean, now I'm kind of sober. Jesus Christ, how do I get up here? So they sent some beer up and I drank the beer and came down. But the next day, the guilt and remorse were just consuming. And I'm in the dorm, and I'm walking to the bathroom with one of my god-awful hangovers. Just, they never quit. I'm grateful that I didn't learn how to fix my hangovers, or I might not have this many years sober. I had just alcoholic poisoning every time I drank. But anyway, that morning, we're walking down the hall, and now this is Miss Goody Two-Shoes, and a gal walks by me, and she goes, "My gosh, we can't believe how you were acting, and the words you were saying were just, we didn't even know you knew those words." And again, just instinct, alcoholic instantly, to just boo it off, "I don't care, big deal, so what?" But mortified inside. But the front, the hide. Don't show them your embarrassment. Blow it off. And again, real, real sick. So that was my first drunk, and I continued to drink in college. That's where I did most of my drinking. And as I said, I was always more or less insanely drunk. I remember went to a dance, and we decided to drink before the dance. And this is sort of, I felt like my drinking always kind of ruined. I never had the good time or the nice dinner or whatever was planned. I didn't even make it that far. But I remember going to a dance and again, now somebody's shaking me and saying, what's your name? Tell us your name. We'll find somebody to come get you and help you. And just always more or less insanely drunk. And I remember giving him another name, not my real name. I said, no, I'm Susie or something like that. Finally made it home. During this time in college, I'm a psychology major, of course, making straight A's. And then every weekend, starting Friday night, I'd have my one night horrendous drunk. And then Saturday and Sunday to sober up and then to be the good kid again. Go to school, get your good grades. It's this dual personality the book talks about. I really identified with that. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And whoever that person was that did those things because of I had a conscience and I had a good upbringing, and those things ate at me. They were horrible to me that I would do those things, which, as I'll continue to share, ended up with someone saying, who are you and where are we? That's pretty much my story, is leaving the bar, leaving the party with some stranger, and getting in horrible sex scenes, and sobering up the next day, wondering, looking to see if your car is damaged, did you do anything in your car, wondering if you're pregnant, wondering if you have some other disease, wondering who that was you were with. But I'll tell you, very quickly, I just became a shell of a person. I just disconnected from my heart and my soul somehow, I guess, to put up with who I was becoming. I would go home on weekends. My parents never saw me drink, so when I joined AA, they were quite shocked. I would go home on the weekends, sometimes after the Friday night drunk, and my mother, she just said, oh, honey, you're so tired, you're studying so hard, and you're just, school is so hard on you, and you're making these good grades, let me take care of you, and, you know, the lies. We lie to everybody. We instinctively lie. And that's why AA's basic premise is rigorous honesty. You will not stay sober if you're not rigorously honest. We lie when the truth is better. It's just, you know, so we get it in our mind that somehow, I'm just going to say this. And I used to, you know, we all told those whoppers in the bars and who you were. But anyway, my parents didn't ever see me drink. Then I got pregnant. As my second year of college, and I got pregnant. And as I've shared, I'm 48 years sober. I'm 73 years old. So in those days, abortions weren't legal. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And the summer was coming. I'm pregnant. I can't tell my mom. I can't disappoint those people who love me, who trust me, who are giving me their hard-earned money to go to college, you know, scraping, you know, and now look what I've done. Look who I am. What a disappointment. I had an older brother who was a major in the Air Force in Florida, and he had four kids, and he'd recently got divorced. He invited me out for the summer to help take care of his kids. And again, I didn't tell anybody my secret of being pregnant. And, finally, I'm 4 months pregnant, and my brother says to me, what is wrong with you? All you do is sit on that couch and just stare. And I finally had to tell him. And my mother flew out to Florida, and he knew, in those days, they had places where abortions would happen illegally, and he knew a owner of a bar, my brother, my older brother. He knew the owner of a bar where the go-go girls, I'm dating myself, when his go-go girl dancers in his bar would get pregnant, he would arrange abortions for them at this place. And I'll just tell a little bit about it. It's quite a story. I think it's worth telling because it shows us that no amount of fear, no amount of terror, no amount of dysfunction makes us get sober. So they told my mom and my brother, we'll take her. This man is going to drive her. We have to drive through several states to Alabama. We'll leave at 3 a.m. and we're not telling you where she's going, and we'll bring her back. So my mother, what I put my mother through is to let her daughter go with some unknown stranger 3 states away to have an abortion and maybe make it through it or not. So that's what we do to people in our lives, right? We think, oh, it's just hurting me, or big deal. As a mother now, I just can't even imagine how gut-wrenching that was. Because I had passed the point at which you know, can have just the sort of the scraping, I basically had to have the baby. They had a doctor come in. I was dropped off at this house. I think it was some kind of underworld house. There were all kinds of people driving up and leaving and money changing hands and shifty looking characters and other girls coming and staying in other bedrooms. But it took 4 days for me to deliver a dead baby at 4 months. And just being there by myself and scared, little girl from Dos Palos, no experience. And I think that is why I just shut down. You shut down, this is not happening, and you just become barely ahead. That's a lot of what AA is the unthawing and going deep. And we can't do that till we get to the safety of AA. We can't look at that stuff, but within the safety of Alcoholics Anonymous, we can be free of it. So my mom told me, when they called the doctor, this lady ran the house. She was like the madam. And I guess once I was okay, she notified my brother. And what she said, being a Southern woman, is your angel is ready. And my brother thought I died. And he was to come get the body, that I was an angel. So, I mean, I just feel for them. My brother came and got me. And the summer was over. My mother and I flew back to my home in Dos Palos. And it's late August now. Both my parents loved me, hugged me, were so good to me. There was never a moment's lecture, never any condemnation. So I just am very lucky. So I want to tell this part of the story too, because it really, to me, it's just such an epitome. So I had a girlfriend who was getting married the 1st of September, and college wasn't to start yet. And she said, would you come be my bridesmaid? And I said, sure. Now, when I got back from Florida, I swore off men, I swore off sex, I swore off alcohol. I swore it all off, man. I am not doing any of that shit ever again. Zero tolerance, none ever. I could look what's happened to me. No one in their right mind would ever drink again. So I drive down to Bakersfield, where my friend was getting married, and because I'm in the wedding party, Friday night is the rehearsal dinner, and we do the rehearsal, and then we go for a lovely dinner, and there's this guy walking around with champagne, and all I remember from that night is my handout with the glass, with the champagne glass. I mean, champagne, I mean, I guess you could turn down a lot of stuff, but this isn't the night to be sober, especially free champagne, all you can drink. I don't know what my thinking was, to be honest with you. It doesn't matter what our thinking is. By then, the obsession and the disease of alcoholism had taken hold, and there is no choice. And that's why I stay sober. I don't ever, ever want to be in a position in my life where I have no choice about my actions, about my feelings, about what I do. to be a victim of a disease that makes you just so ugly and awful. Well, anyway, I'll tell this. I hope it's not in poor taste, but at 3 a.m. that night, I woke up in the hotel room of all 6 groomsmen. And that was very embarrassing, and I snuck away. Now, I was so drunk, I didn't remember. Now it's the early morning, the wedding is now this day, it's Saturday. I don't even know where the wedding is. And I hardly remember. She had let me stay at her house. So I had to call the Bakersfield. I think we were in McFarland. It was McFarland, excuse me. And it was a really tiny town. So I thought, I bet if I call the florist, they'll know where this wedding is. I'm calling a florist to figure out where I'm supposed to be. So she tells me, and I finally get there and walk down the aisle. Can you believe I showed my face? When I think about that now, it gives me willies down my back that I would show up. I should have just gotten in my car and driven home and let them have their wedding. No, I show up green and pukey and walk down the aisle with my friend, and then I go to the party afterwards. Get drunk. So to me, that tells us that this is not a matter of willpower, and that's a very difficult one, at least it was for me when I first got sober, that I thought of myself as so capable, and I was young, I didn't know about being powerless. When you're that young, you still think you can do anything anyway, that you have that silly ego, young person's ego, that you've not done any life to know that you're going to get your ass kicked and smashed and life's going to just, you still think you can do anything. So anyway, let's see, where am I on time? Okay. Let's see, to speed this up a little bit, I met my husband in a bar called The Casual, and he and I had our neuroses mesh instantly, and we became an item. He was a full-blown alcoholic. Now, I want to tell you, I've jumped ahead a little bit. I've gotten my master's degree in psychology. A lot of good that does you. Anyway, I'm so dated that at that time, what they now call the Department of Behavioral Health was the Department of Mental Hygiene. And I work for the State Department of Mental Hygiene. And I'm drinking now. I'm out of school. My husband's drinking. We're having the knockdown drag outs. I'm throwing his clothes out the window and the suitcases. We're doing this, what we call the suitcase drill. I hate you. You bastard. Here's all your goddamn clothes. And then we're making up and kissing and going to the bar. We did that. Did a lot of rounds of that. Moved into this hotel complex. I knew I'd died and gone to heaven. Not a hotel. An apartment complex. He and I moved in, and I knew I'd died and gone to heaven when Sunday morning all these young people started coming out of their apartment doors toward the pool of the apartment, and they all had drinks in their hands at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. Oh, this is the place for me. And it makes me kind of sad that I think in those days there was nothing more wonderful than drinking in a bar and dancing and looking for Prince Charming. That was my idea of heaven. And I will tell you what my idea of heaven is when I get to the end, but it sure is a far cry from being in a dark bar with a bunch of drunk people acting like an ass. But that was at my time, really. I just thought, I am so cool. I have this psychology degree, but yet I'm a fun party girl. Look at me party. So my husband and I are fighting and I told him, you're a bad drunk, man. You got to do something. You can't hold a job. You wrecked a car. I mean, I go to work and I drink in bars out of glasses. This guy's drinking out of a bottle. Sitting at home, no job. I mean, that's an alcoholic, right? Well, interestingly, at work, is this amazing woman. She's 55. She is the most dynamic, attractive, wildly wonderful woman. And she's 12 years sober in AA, and she tells everybody. And this office where we work, she's the administrative assistant. It's the regional office of the Department of Mental Hygiene. A psychiatrist runs the office. There's a bunch of psychiatric social workers. There's me with my psychology degree. And there's this lady who's the secretary running around telling everybody, look at this journal you guys just got. This says they're trying to cure us alcoholics. They're always trying to cure us alcoholics. They want us alcoholics to learn how to drink. You guys in the psych field are crazy. And one article she was laughing at was about your sip magnitude. Alcoholics have a big sip magnitude. If they just control their damn sip magnitude, they wouldn't have to get so drunk. The other one was back in those days, they did what they call, my brain's not working, but it would be shock therapy, like a negative thing. Like if you think about drinking, we're going to hit you with a cattle prod. We do that enough, and by God, you won't want to drink. And I thought, shit, now that I got sober, I got more than a cattle prod going on out there in my drinking. Ain't no amount of little cattle prod electricity going through my body is going to say, oh, I don't want to drink anymore. So anyway, this lady is just talking about being sober and how much she loves being sober, and I'm just attracted to her. I don't think I'm alcoholic, but I just like this crazy, wild woman. But by then I realize my husband is a serious alcoholic and he needs help, and I take him over to her house, and I said, can you fix him? You talk all about this A&A thing. What do you think about fixing him? And, my husband got on fire with AA. And here I am. Well, wait a minute. I wouldn't mean that. I didn't mean go to meetings and not be home. And can't he, like, drink normally? What? I don't like this. He's gone every night. He loves AA. He's talking about his new friends. Then he starts talking about God, which is like, whoa, you have gotten in with the Moonies, man. This is too much. But he loved AA, and he walked out that door every night, and he had perfume and stuff on. So I know what it's like to be the wife of a guy that's going to AA. I feel for the wives. I always want to talk to him and tell him we'll keep him safe. We won't let him jump on any girls if we can help it. So anyway, he got on fire with AA. But it only lasted a little while. We both decided we could drink normally, socially, and we both tried it for a while. And he loved AA so much, he would go hang outside the meetings with his bottle in his pocket, just wishing he could go in and be part of it. But he knew you can't, you have to be sober to go in there. I didn't know anything about AA at that point, other than it took my drinking partner away, and I wasn't going for it. Anyway, my husband got real, real, real sick. Both of us, very young, got very sick, and he was ready to go to Skid Row. He goes, I can't do life. I'm leaving. I'm headed for Skid Row. And he decided to call that. He'd met a guy in AA that he liked, and he'd try AA one more time. And he's sober now 48 years and 6 months. And again, he got on fire with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I resented the hell out of it. I resented it, and but the day came when I was playing those games. He was getting ready to go to me. I said, "Why? Just stay home. Just stay here with me. If you loved me, you would stay here with me. What is this?" And I'll never forget it. We all have those periods in our sobriety when you have that moment. And he looked at me and he goes, I'm going where my friends are. And he slammed the door. And I knew the door was shut, and I knew the game, the jig was over, that I'd lost my drinking partner. I'd lost my, you know, the guy that was gonna, and now I'm sitting there all alone and pretty lost and pretty, no clue I'm an alcoholic, truly. But I called the lady, Annette, I worked with, and I went to a meeting with her. And some part of me maybe knew I was, but not most of me. Maybe I wanted to see where my husband was going. Maybe I had an inkling, who knows? Maybe God just said, get your ass to a meeting, and that's how he did it. I didn't like the meeting. I felt sorry for all those people, that they were such sick, sad, and sorry alcoholics. They were all old, and they didn't have anywhere else to go on a Tuesday night but these horrible church basement meetings and drink that bad coffee and smoke their cigarettes and tell their tale of woe. But I loved Annette. I loved her. I wanted to be with her, and she went to 5 meetings a week, and then she went to coffee till midnight. Meeting started at 8:30. I just hung on to her. So quickly, I sat in the meetings, and I kept thinking, you know, I feel kind of guilty being here. These people are really sick. They're really bad, and they need all this help, and I feel bad taking up a chair. I'm not that bad. I didn't go to jail. No divorce, no beat. I didn't beat my kids. I mean, I'm just not that bad. And I really know what it's like to be in that position where the wall is down. And I tell you, no human power gets through that wall. No human power. But here's what got through to me. When they read that chapter, that part of the book, and you read it tonight, God love you. It's worth a case of a jitters if you get a profound knowledge of your condition. And I wanted to be an AA, kind of, but I just felt, I'm not really that bad. So I set out one night to follow the instructions in the book to see if I could do some controlled drinking. And, well, I'm here. You know how that went. Really bad drunk, met an old boyfriend, drove down a major street in Fresno on the wrong side of the street. I didn't get a ticket. When I got home, I was so drunk, my husband tried to tape record me to prove what a bad drunk I was. And I always laugh because in those days, it was a reel-to-reel. There was no such thing as a little tape recorder. It was like a big box that weighed about 40 pounds, and it was reel-to-reel. And he's trying to catch me on tape to say, see, look, you're a bad drunk. Anyway, I realized I was a bad drunk. I got it that night, and I went back to AA. Thank you. What is that, 3 minutes? 4 minutes. Okay. What I want to say is I love my sponsor. I can't imagine getting out sober without being very, very close to your sponsor, a sponsor who does this. She was hard asked about the program. She was very clear. It was right out of the book. We did everything out of the book. We opened the book. We followed the instructions, and she taught me that. There's a lot of stuff in meetings. You're going to hear a lot of stuff, honey, and that's not the program unless it is, unless that person knows it. So I got an amazing foundation. She was my higher power for 2 years. All we did was AA. My husband was sober. I was sober. We went to conferences. We went to the World International Conference. We answered the teleservice every Wednesday night, 5-6 meetings a week, started a meeting in our home, and I just embraced it, and that's who I am. It's all or nothing. And the book says that, you know, half measures will avail you nothing, and I've been fortunate to watch it. It either in or out, you completely give yourself or you don't. So those of you that you're new, you know, I have just a few sayings, suit up and show up, and I use that to myself today. Everything I learned that first year is what keeps me sober today. And I loved your readings tonight about working with newcomers when all else fails. So tonight was a great opportunity because I've been pretty weird behind what's going on in our world. It reminded me, my sponsor used to say to me, you know, I think we're the sane ones in AA, and they're the crazy ones out there. And I was just hearing her voice because she's passed away, but I was hearing that today. And so looking forward to tonight's meeting to be around sane, sober people. And I want to say this. There's something about us that thinks we get here and everything gets perfect. And what I want to say is I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I do not have active alcoholism, and I consider myself recovered ED as it's used in the book. But I'm not recovered from my human condition. And the root of my problem is selfish, self-centered, and it continues to be the root of my problem. And AA gives me the way to deal with it. And I'm the one who has to pick up those tools and use them on this. And I haven't quite 48 years, and I still have not arrived. You know, I don't, every day I have to make a man, not every day, but I mean, I'm human, and you will be human, and we will feel all kinds of feelings. We don't drink over them. And that's what you're here for, is to stay sober. Remember that. So if you don't get Prince Charming or a new car or the job or the kids back, that isn't the hardest, to become sober. And so we can be of maximum service to God and those about us. Thank you so much, Bill, for having me.